I think that these amendments are necessary. I think that they are necessary in the continuing pursuit. We spent a lot of time talking about people, where our focus is going to be the dealers. Our focus is going to be the people delivering. Well, I think it's the time that the dealers, the manufacturers, and the distributors realize that not only are they going to be held account for their illegal conduct in the distribution of narcotics, but the end effect, that is, if drugs kill people and you're going to sell something that kills people, then you're going to be held accountable for murder. And that's all that we're trying, that's all that I can see the intent of this bill. As to the second portion of this bill, actually I should say the third portion, which I said appears to be a little bit unrelated, I don't want to take away from the importance of item number K, assault in the first degree. It's easy, but even just by its simple placement, I know psychologically it's easy to lose this element of the bill in the reading of it. And I think that that is an extremely important amendment to the felony murder statutes in Oregon. I have tried at least two very serious murder cases that involved a defendant who was involved in the racial killing of the victim. And I say that because I know that there have been other bills addressed that want to make that, to raise that to the aggravated murder statutes. I want to show you an example, though, of what happens without having assault in the first degree in here as a felony murder. Around May of 1985, a young man by the name of Jap Van Dang was in a telephone booth at 72nd and Killingsworth in Portland, Oregon. He stayed in the phone booth too long for a man by the name of Gary Lester Peterson. Gary Lester Peterson did not like people who were of Asian descent. That we found out later on, actually. He attacked Mr. Jap Van Dang in the phone booth and stabbed him three times, stabbed him once in the neck. When the case was brought to trial, he was indicted for murder. He was tried on a murder count. During the trial, his defense became, I did not intend to kill Mr. Van Dang. I only intended to stab him. There was no jury instruction in place, because it was not the law, that if you intend to cause somebody serious physical injury, that is, you intend to cause them a substantial risk of death, and a death occurs, you can be held responsible for murder. That did not exist. The only thing that the jury heard was, you must specifically intend to kill somebody if you want to be convicted of murder. But the logical argument by the defense and the logical argument presented to the jury was, he only intended to cause him serious physical injury, therefore that was a reckless act, and therefore what resulted in that case was Mr. Gary Lester Peterson was only convicted of manslaughter in the first degree.
You might note that exactly the same situation has occurred up in Clackamas County with the Ecclesia trial, where they could not charge murder because they thought they could prove that the torture was intentionally to kill the poor little girl. This committee will have that exact bill. I agree with you that in both those situations, you're splitting the worst type of judicial hair to write that type of instruction. You, for my money, if you seriously intend to hurt someone, you intend to kill them.
Well, by the legal definition of serious physical injury, so serious physical injury includes a substantial risk of death. Now, what we currently have is, if you intend to cause somebody a substantial risk of death and they die, you will be convicted of manslaughter in the first degree. And manslaughter in the first degree is exactly the same class felony that assault in the first degree is. And that does not strike me as fair or just, and it certainly doesn't strike me as the intent of what the citizens want or what the public would expect. Anybody would expect that if you intend to cause the death of somebody and they die, that you should certainly face a serious crime.
Well,
and that's the reason why I would not like to see the assault in the first degree get lost along with everything else. I know that it was deleted in the last session, and it is an extremely important part of the process, and it's an extremely important part of our prosecutions in holding people accountable for the effects that they have on their victims.
May I inquire?
Certainly, Representative Mannix.
Why was it deleted in the last session?
I have no idea.
Started by the Senate or by the House?
Mr. Bradley may be able to more appropriately answer that. I'm not quite sure. Mr. Bradley from the District Attorney's Office is present for the record. He is more aware of why it was deleted than I was. He and I had discussed it before.
This might be best left
for work session, or
just left off the record. We don't do off the record here.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
The reason it was deleted last time, John Bradley for the District Attorney's Office. It was deleted because it was felt that the package last time related to drugs and it shouldn't be in it. The reason it was added was because it was a vehicle in which it could have been introduced.
Thank you.
Okay. But the fact that whether or not it relates to, it does relate to drugs, and it can relate to drugs in this aspect, especially at this point. If we have an armed guard at a crack house who is trying to protect the confines of that crack house, and he kills somebody or shoots them and says he's trying to shoot them in the leg, or he was just trying to fire in the air and he blows their head off, he still has a technical legal defense that he did not intend to commit a murder. And we do not have that covered.
What? I found myself returning to the classical common law I learned in law school, but I seem to remember a definition somewhere that you shoot at someone, that means you kill them.
There's an old common law rule that when you use a deadly, I practiced in Pennsylvania for a couple of years and got to be very familiar with common law rules. And the old common law rule was that if you pointed or used a deadly or dangerous weapon in or near at a vital part of the body, it was presumptive that you were intending to kill the person. Now, Oregon is not a common law state, and we have Oregon Supreme Court opinions that say that there will be no presumptions in criminal cases. So it becomes simply and solely a question of whether or not we can get circumstantial evidence strong enough to determine what the mental state of the defendant was at the time. There is no longer any presumptive instruction or presumptive law relative to the use of a deadly or dangerous weapon on a vital part of the body.
Just a little aside, I don't know what Representative Mannix of the committee, but the more and more I work with the model penal code, and I've worked with this for years now, the less and less I'm in love with it. I tend to find myself going back to the old murder definitions, which I think have a certain content in the popular mind, and we're not that bad in retrospect.
A lot to be said for common law.
Well, come down and take my course.
You say you have three suggestions, or you had other suggestions?
I covered three the three areas as far as I believe that there should be in the amendments in the bill itself. I can go back over those for the chair if you'd like.
Any questions of the witness? If not, thank you very much, and we'll go on to Rosanna
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. And I'm going to try to be very sensitive to not repeating what you heard. And I'm so relieved that I am not the technical side of this bill. And you have heard the technical side eloquently. I have prepared a packet of information for you. I apologize not doing it earlier when our bill started to cross your desk. And so I took this time now to put together some materials for you to take back and look at as each bill comes through. As you know, and as you heard today, that this bill today is a part of our total package, and you have this brochure in your packet. It's actually identical to Senate Bill 457, which was introduced by Senator Phillips and Representative Burton and co-sponsored by 47 legislators, 14 senators, and 32 representatives. And as you heard earlier, we ask you please not to consider this particular piece of legislation in isolation. I would like to just take a moment to explain to you that by putting this package together, we are trying to create a new climate in the state of Oregon by dealing with adult attitudes and behavior toward the use of illicit drugs. In dealing with prevention in the state, we must succeed in changing the adult viewpoint, and this is so vital. Nationally, our reputation is that we have no jail beds, that we are tolerant of drug use, and that we have weak laws. We have the distinction of being number three in marijuana cultivation, and it is rumored that we may be number one in coming close to it. We're number three in methamphetamine production. Cocaine is so prevalent that the price has fallen 50% in 4 years in the state of Oregon. Portland has one of the nation's largest heroin overdose rates, and our Oregon youth use illicit drugs at higher levels than youth nationally. I have put into your packet quite a bit of information on the youth drug survey conducted by this state in 1986 and in 1988. The 1988 data is not encouraging, as we have students nationally, their drug use has going down steadily. Our Oregon 11th graders are using all illicit drugs at higher levels than their counterparts nationally. That would be the average use by seniors nationally. Our 11th graders are using at a younger age and using more drugs at a higher level. The use of marijuana by our 8th graders in just 2 years has increased 80%, and our 8th graders' use of cocaine has increased fourfold in just 2 years. Now, these bills were put together to deal with the youth and improve Oregon's livability, and there are many things that we must do to change these attitudes, and this bill is just one part of that. I submitted my testimony in complete form for you, and I'm not going to take time to read it all. I do want to bring up one issue, though, because I have been before you 3 times in the last month, and I have heard marijuana discussed many times. And it's going to come up every time a drug bill comes across our desks, your desk and my desk. We must deal with the misinformation about marijuana when we deal with these drug issues. In the 1980s, it's a very potent drug. It's more potent than hashish. It is physically and mentally addicting. In the Oregon state-supported treatment centers, 35% of the clientele are there because their primary drug of addiction is marijuana. Marijuana is the gateway drug to cocaine addiction. Cocaine users have reported that 93% of them used marijuana first before they even tried cocaine. Only 2% of our cocaine users do not use marijuana, and 98% of them use cocaine and marijuana and other drugs at the same time. Marijuana crosses the placenta and causes fetal cannabis syndrome, which is almost identical to fetal alcohol syndrome, which you might have heard about. The potency of Oregon-grown Sinzimia is about 15% to 18%. In the early 70s, it was half of 1%. So we've gone from half of 1% to 18% due to growing techniques and technology. Our action plan goes together like pieces of a puzzle to reshape the attitude and the behavior of our children and our adults. We want to change Oregon's national reputation as an easy mark for crime. House Bill 2430 and other measures in our package say to the drug dealers, the manufacturers, and the users that they all must accept the responsibility and pay the price for their actions. House Bill 2430 specifically addresses the distribution of illicit drugs. We must not tolerate individuals who sell poison to our citizens. What case that comes into mind is the young boy, 18-year-old from Gresham, who was involved in a major cocaine distribution center for cocaine. This young man lived in a condominium at $1,000 a month. He had 3 sports cars, averaging about $30,000. When he was arrested at Gresham High School, he had $18,000 in his gym bag. I think the most startling thing about this whole situation is the students at his school, and then when the Portland Youth Forum which is a group of high school students throughout Portland, were asked about this, the majority of the students did not see a problem with one of their classmates selling cocaine to their friends and to the vicinity. They could not see a problem. They said, he's not hurting anybody, he's just making money. This must be addressed, and that's where we talk about changing our attitudes as adults so we can change the attitudes and help our children realize how serious this is. In order to ensure the Oregon comeback and preserve our vital resources, which are our children, I'm asking, and we are asking, this legislative session to hang tough and to be tough. The citizens are watching and are more than willing to support you all the way. And speaking on behalf of the thousands of citizens that I communicate with, we ask you to pass House Bill 2430.
Questions of the witness?
Representative Courtney.
The Senate side.
Pardon?
Is there a bill?
Senate Bill 457, Representative Courtney.
What about Senate Bill 457? I mean, I understand this bill came out last session and didn't make it. Do you have any, is that, we got to have another repeat performance to the extent that you can tell at this stage, given where you're coming from?
You mean where something dies in the Senate?
Yeah, that's, I use another term. You going to whisper to me something into it, Mr. Chair? Excuse me, strike it. I've just been told that we can't go through this again. We've just been through it once, so let it pass. So please forgive me. But certain things need to be on the record, Mr. Chair, but in deference to the Chair, I will not ask the question.
Well, Representative Mannix already did. That's what I'm... It died in the Senate.
No, I know it died in the Senate. I understand it died in the Senate. The question is this a dawning of a new era? Because this question is constantly put before me. These bills have been here before. Any evidence of what's going to happen in the Senate? Is there any indication? Now, that's all I'm trying to get a feeling for. I know what the legislative history here is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mannix.
It is my impression that we are going to assist in the dawning of a new era. We're going to certainly move these bills as fast as we can so that they have every opportunity to flower and bloom in the other body.
Mr. Chair and Representative Courtney, the citizens have asked us the same question as we traveled all over the state, and that's where we all have to work together to make sure that these bills do get passed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Ms. Creighton, there was some discussion earlier on the bill about including manufacture in the so-called felony murder approach. Would I be correct in assuming that Citizens for Drug-Free Oregon would have no problem with that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, we haven't discussed it as a group, but we did have information today, and I would think it would be fair in saying we would support that.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Kirshner.
Oops.
Have a question? Somebody have a question?
No. Excuse me. I'm Mr. Kirshner today.
Oh. Sorry, me. Mr. Kirshner, what do you have to say?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon, and Mr. Jeffrey Kushner, our state alcohol and drug abuse director, is in Coos Bay today. And he was asked by Senator Paul Phillips and Representative Mike Burton to give an overall view of his experiences of the drug problem in Oregon. And I'm going to give you the letter, but I'd like to read you one or two paragraphs, if it's all right.
Short.
Right. I'll read fast. I'm going to read the part that he lays out the foundation of how difficult it is to do prevention and asking your help in this effort. It is the Oregon Legislative Assembly that can really put the message out, not only to Oregon but across this country, that drug manufacturing, dealing, and use will not be tolerated anymore. I must tell you that it becomes more difficult to be effective with prevention programs in our schools and with our families when our children can go into record shops and gift stores, buy magazines telling them how to manufacture drugs. It is difficult to be successful in treating methamphetamine addicts or cocaine-addicted women, for instance, when our communities are awash with illicit drugs because the dealers won't do their time or they because of the liberal laws. And he is asking you to support this legislation in our package.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Why don't we close the hearing on 2430 and move into the hearing on 2518. I believe Mr. Wilhelm is the first in our list. This is a House Bill 2518 provides that all computer crime is punishable by a maximum 5 years imprisonment, $100,000 fine, or both. Bill Helen.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name's Gary Wilhelms, for the record, and I am Director of Legislative Affairs for U.S. West Communications in Oregon. And I don't plan to take too much of your time this afternoon. House Bill 2518 is a simple bill. The existing computer crime statute, ORS 164.377, was passed in the 1985 session. And it is a good start, but it needs a little bit of fine-tuning. Our security department contacted us during the interim and asked if there wasn't something that could be done to strengthen the law by stiffening the penalties for computer hacking. It seems that phone companies are prime targets of computer hackers. And I asked our security agent to send me down a couple of examples this morning, which I'd like to relate to you at this time. In May of 1987, a computer hacker entered one of our systems in U.S. West and gained access to proprietary information, including non-published numbers and addresses and telephone facilities of several people that he didn't care for. He had the ability to manipulate our system and disconnect their telephone service. One of his plans was to manipulate our system to gain access to an automatic teller machine line, that is an ATM line, and then transfer funds from a bank into his own account. Essentially, he would have robbed a bank, and there wouldn't have been a way to prove who did it. We are at the current time investigating a case where one of our customers claims an acquaintance has entered our system and gained access to his toll records, thus finding out who he is talking to, when he's talking to them, and for how long. Now, all of the above information is proprietary at the current time by law, yet it is not a felony to get it unless it is sold. And the example that our agent points out to me is, think what a criminal could do with the non-published numbers and addresses of all the judges, police officers, and federal agents involved in drug investigations. In addition, it appears that if a hacker managed to insert a computer virus in any of our systems, the hacker would be guilty of a misdemeanor, even though he or she might effectively shut down the system involved. It is true that if the hacker accessed our billing system and in some way experienced monetary gain as a result, the hacker would be guilty of a felony under other statutes if the monetary gain was significant enough. And under the theft of services statute, if you steal $500 or more, that's the threshold where it breaks into a felony. However, if the hacker accesses our database, obtains proprietary or confidential information such as non-published numbers or addresses of drug enforcement officers, for example, or manipulates credit or other information without actually stealing anything with a fixed value, the hacker would be guilty of a misdemeanor. We believe that accessing or manipulating our database is much more significant than stealing $500 worth of services or credit. Thus, we believe it's appropriate to make all computer crime a Class C felony. And a final thought, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, under existing law, it appears that if I take my hammer and bash the IBM PC that you have in your office, that I am guilty of a Class C felony. However, if I take my computer and hack the database of the state of Oregon or any of the many databases of the state of Oregon, I am guilty of a simple Class A misdemeanor. Now, I think you will agree that the potential for harm is at least as great in the latter example than in the former. I hope you will act favorably on House Bill 2518, a simple but good bill. Thank you.
Mr. Wilhelms, let me ask the first question. I see the purpose of your bill, and I probably will support the bill, but I can hear the argument that's going to be thrown at us right now. In fact, I think there was even an editorial on it. So why, you know, this is what it's going to be labeled, use a felony clone.
It's going to be labeled a what, Mr.
Felony
Chair?
Clone. But you know, in other words, what's your, if you can make for this committee, because I think somebody in this committee may have used it, what's the argument about why we should be creating another felony? Do you feel a compelling need here, and is there a real threat to society because of this situation?
Well, there's a threat to the society that I perform my day-to-day operations in, yes. I mean, it goes beyond just what happens to telephone companies, but you know, in my world, if they hack our database, we've got big trouble. Society could have a big trouble if they put a virus in the Portland, one of the Portland central offices, and shut that central office down. Society, beyond just the phone company, has got a big problem. Now, we have been assured by our computer gurus, who immediately checked when this last virus situation occurred, that that is not going to happen in our central offices.
Did you believe them?
Well, I mean, it wasn't supposed to happen where it happened before. Yeah. I'm not that much of a computer guru myself.
Representative Mannix.
Thank you. I'd like to harken back to some earlier testimony on another bill where we talked about the common law, some of the common sense concepts of the common law, and perhaps addressing the chairman's question to you. When we're dealing with hacking, some of the popular notion is, oh, this is just an innocent prank-like activity where no terrible harm might be intended. On the other hand, it might be a very non-innocent activity where a terrible harm is intended. And looking at this bill, my impression is it is extremely difficult to come up with a differentiation among levels of hacking, that if we make it a Class C felony, I'm almost making a statement here, but I want your reaction to it. If we make it a Class C felony, we've said to society, this is pretty heavy stuff. We consider this to be a felony, not just a misdemeanor. You might succeed in convincing a judge after you're convicted of this act that the judge might be lenient with you because you were just, a college kid who was playing with another college kid's computer instead of someone who is accessing, say, a U.S. West's network for theft purposes. What I'm trying to get around to with this common law discussion is, in the old days, we had problems with burglary. Burglary in the common law context, as I recall, was some illegal entry, that is, some entry without permission of a residence with a purpose to of committing a crime within the residence.
At night.
At night.
Yes.
And the reason burglary itself was set up as a crime was we couldn't always tell exactly what you necessarily were going to do, and the professor chairman may help me with this. So we just said, we don't want you going in at all at night into a residence. And so the parallel I see here is we're saying, we don't want you going into someone else's computer at all. And if you do it with any kind of intention to commit any kind of act, you're going to get the hammer. Now, are you comfortable with that notion that we're just going to jump on everybody and it's going to be a felony for everybody and take a chance that judges are going to be considerate of those who may have had less than noble but not totally criminal intentions?
Representative Mannix, I personally am comfortable with that. And my company is comfortable with that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Courtney.
Among other things, I'm computer illiterate. The virus, I know everybody else knows, a virus is...
I didn't know until yesterday afternoon, Representative.
So you didn't know that either until yesterday
afternoon? No, I did not, but I did ask
our... Well, then I don't feel so stupid.
I don't think it's...
My daughter and I were discussing that the other
day. Fine, I don't want you.
The way it was described to me, and it could probably be done in a variety of ways, but a computer virus is basically a program that you would enter into a computer. In the case of the famous case, it was remotely entered, but it would be entered, and it is a program that feeds on itself and thus continues to become all-consuming in the computer system. Like a virus would grow and consume your body if it was a disease, that's what it does into this computer system. It just continues to feed on itself as a problem, and the answer creates another question, which creates another answer, which creates another question, and it just keeps multiplying and building until finally it just shuts the system down. And I thought that was interesting. I can see how it would happen, and I can see where it would be a flat disaster if it occurred in some computer systems in this country.
Thank you.
I'd like to jump back to the global question I was asking you, because looking at the bill, I'm pretty comfortable with the first part of computer crime, because if you knowingly, this is beginning at line 27 of page 1, if you knowingly access, attempt to access, or use, or attempt to use any computer and so forth for the purpose of devising or executing any scheme or artifice to defraud, hey, let's hit them with the hammer. Obtaining money, property, or services by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises, the hammer again, let's do it. Committing theft, the hammer again.
Also, subsection 3 on page 2, if you knowingly and without authorization, you're altering, damaging, or destroying computer data, hey, the hammer again. It's subsection 4 that I wonder about. Knowingly and without authorization uses, accesses, or attempts to access any computer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, commits computer crime. And then we say that all of these are a Class C felony. It seems to me that when you're getting back to the burglary situation, up to that point we're okay because there's some intent to commit some kind of illegal act or certainly nasty act that we ought to make illegal. Number 4, if I'm a college student and I knowingly and without authorization walk over to another student's computer and play with it, I've just committed a Class C felony. Do I misread this?
I can't answer the question as to whether or not you're misreading it.
Number 4, it seems to be setting out a separate one. I'm real nervous about that because, you know, I may just want to see how the program works.
It could be such a thing, Representative Mannix, that there should be an additional classification built here for to separate out the instances that you're describing and keep them as a misdemeanor. However, subsection 4 is the language that talks about hacking when there's no monetary gain derived therefrom. And that is exactly what we're concerned about. That's the case of the person inserting the virus into the system. That's the case of the person manipulating our credit information.
No, it's